This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This Thursday, December 1st, is World AIDS Day, which started in 1988 to raise awareness about the HIV and AIDS pandemic. Now, almost 30 years later, many Americans may associate AIDS more with sub-Saharan Africa or deep urban poverty. But around 40 new cases of HIV were diagnosed in New Hampshire in 2014, and it's estimated that 20% of all HIV-positive people do not know they have the virus. Meanwhile, new treatments and preventative measures are helping to combat the spread of HIV, but factors like stigma and low funding continue to hamper progress, including here in the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, the status of AIDS in New Hampshire, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for this segment of our show. Dr. Tim Leahy joins us, Associate Professor of Medicine at Dartmouth and a clinical immunologist with a focus on HIV and tuberculosis. And Dr. Leahy, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Laura Byrne, Executive Director of the HIV-HCV Resource Center in Lebanon, which serves people in New Hampshire and Vermont. And Laura Byrne, welcome back. Good to have you, too.
Thank you so much.
Well, I want to turn to you first, Dr. Leahy. How do you think your average American views this disease today?
You know, I do think that a fair number of Americans feel like HIV is somewhere over there, not related to their lives. And so one of the challenges we have as HIV educators is to not alarm people inappropriately, but make sure they understand that there's real risk of HIV transmission, that there's a real need for funding for HIV services, and that more than a million Americans have HIV, and so it's something we should all care about.
Give us a little bit more on that, Dr. Leahy. Somewhere over there.
Yeah, so if you look at HIV in the world, about 37 million people worldwide have it, and a large percentage of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. And certainly the worst effects of the AIDS epidemic are still occurring there, where many people can't access therapy. That's a big problem, and it's really important. But it's a misconception I see in some people that that's really the whole story, when in fact there's also a story of HIV here in the United States, here in New Hampshire, in our small towns, that is also important to treat and diagnose. And there's a complacency that can sometimes come from thinking that HIV is really only something that happens in Africa.
Well,
so we combat that every day.
And I'm looking at some numbers from the CDC. 50,000 Americans still become infected each year. Laura Byrne, what do you think about that complacency that Dr. Leahy talks about?
I think it exists, and I think that people aren't focused on HIV/AIDS anymore because, thank goodness, it's now a treatable disease. But I think that has added to having people not be concerned that they'll get it. I even think that there are people who think that they probably won't get it, even if they engage in risk behaviors. And if they do, oh, they'll take the medications. So I think it's important to raise awareness that HIV still exists, that there are about 50,000 new infections a year in our country, that there are about 30 to 50 new infections in New Hampshire every year, and maybe 11 to 20 in Vermont, and that it's a real thing, and we should pay attention to it and get everybody tested.
Well, and as Dr. Leahy alluded, you know, a lot of people do think it's mainly a big urban thing and an African, sub-Saharan African thing. Put it, please, Laura, in the New Hampshire context and Vermont, and the idea that, you know, AIDS and HIV is still prevalent in the rural communities that you work with.
Indeed, it is. It's prevalent. We are a low prevalence, low incidence state, but nevertheless, it spans the whole state. There are people living with HIV in every county. Yes, there are the highest concentrations of people living with HIV are in Rockingham in New Hampshire or Chittenden County in Vermont, but nevertheless, there are people throughout the state, and those people need access to services too.
Well, and we will hear in a little bit from someone with Southern New Hampshire AIDS Task Force, but Dr. Leahy, to you first, what other sort of myths or misunderstandings do you constantly run into about HIV/AIDS?
You know, a really big lack of knowledge that many people in our communities and many of our physicians have is about the availability of newer ways to prevent HIV infection. You know, I think many of us know that the ABCs we've been teaching people about for years, abstinence, be faithful, and use condoms, work. But something that many people don't know as much about as they should is the availability of something called PrEP, which is taking medications to prevent HIV acquisition in high-risk people. This is something that can save people at risk from getting HIV, and it's a service that's been available for years, but many at-risk people are not offered it. So that's something we want to make sure people know that they can access if they need it.
Well, that's real interesting. Just remind us, who is an at-risk person, Dr. Leahy?
So PrEP, which stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, is appropriate for people who have high-risk exposures to HIV. So this would include having sex with on a regular basis with a known HIV-positive partner, or having multiple HIV-positive or possibly HIV-positive partners, or sharing needles in the context of drug use. There's a list of indications that providers can ask patients about, that patients can self-identify as having, and that can trigger a whole cascade of care that can prevent HIV from ever happening.
And how do these prevention medicines, Truvada, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Dr.
Leahy,
is the big one out there. How do these work? Is it a vaccine?
So Truvada is one of the medicines that we use to treat HIV in people who have it. And it's so safe and so unlikely to cause side effects that it has now been tested in multiple big studies and shown to prevent people who don't have HIV from getting it. And the way it works is basically by shutting HIV down before it even gets a foothold in the cells of the body.
Wow. Is it a pill?
Yeah, it's a one pill that people take once a day, and it's very well tolerated, and it works great. Of course, you know, if somebody had a very low likelihood of getting HIV, then even the low risk of that pill might not be worth it. But if you have the kinds of risks that I described, it can be the difference between, you know, a life of having to take treatment for HIV that actually has taken root in the body.
So, Dr. Leahy, what's the concern about this medicine and this whole idea of preventative medicine?
You know, one of the things that policymakers and public health officials have to grapple with is that these medicines are still costly, and so we want to make sure we use them wisely. And so making sure that we invest in the money it takes to support the use of these medicines for prevention is really important. You don't want to, you know, sort of spend limited AIDS budget on prevention with a medicine that's expensive for people who don't really need it. On the other hand, you can actually save lives and save a lot of money if you prevent HIV from happening in somebody who otherwise would need investments in their lifelong treatment.
Well, Laura, one of the concerns that I came across yesterday repeatedly is the concern that preventative medicines encourage risky behaviors where, you know, you can engage in all sorts of less than smart behaviors because why not? You've got the drug, so you're all good.
Well, I have heard that before, but I actually feel that people who engage in risky behaviors already engage in risky behaviors. So preventative medicines help them not to acquire HIV. If there are people out there that just will not use condoms, and PrEP is a great thing for those people because it protects them. And so I don't think that it promotes risky behavior. I think it helps people who actually do engage in risky behavior stay free of the virus.
Do you help people access these preventative medicines, Laura?
We do, actually. We offer referrals. It's hard because there are not a lot of general practitioners in rural areas that actually know, that are familiar with prescribing PrEP. So a lot of times people have to learn about how to prescribe it, because the PrEP has most historically been prescribed by HIV doctors. And so we're hoping that more and more general practitioners will learn how to prescribe PrEP.
Wow. So now primary care doctors have to learn how this works, when to prescribe it, when not to, and how to counsel patients if they do prescribe it.
Exactly.
That's kind of a big burden, Dr. Leahy.
It's a big shift in our thinking. As Laura said, many of us have been thinking of HIV care as the province of HIV specialists like me. And I think for many people who have HIV infection, that can be appropriate. However, if we think that people at risk of getting HIV infection constitute a sizable proportion of a primary care provider's patient population, then part of basic primary care for them is to help them stay healthy. This medicine is very safe, but as Laura said, not everybody's familiar with it, so we're going through a lot of statewide education drives now. Dartmouth-Hitchcock actually is trying to figure out how we might be able to support other providers by doing telemedicine and other kinds of remote access advice so that primary care providers can get up to speed and feel comfortable giving Truvada to people who need it.
I'd love your thoughts too, Dr. Leahy, on what I asked Laura Byrne, the concern that if you have preventative medicine, then you can just, go crazy.
Yeah, this is a really common misconception. The way I like to think about it is that, for me personally and for many of us, a decision to have sex or not to have sex is in no way informed by the presence of a pill in a medicine cabinet. It's just not part of the equation. It might be the lighting or the music or the fun that you had that evening, but not the presence of a pill in a medicine cabinet. And I think that sort of helps people understand how this doesn't do it. In fact, if you look at the big studies in which PrEP was proven to work, the users' incidence of sexually transmitted infections did not go up. They were high to begin with because these are people at risk, and they remained high.
But it didn't have the intended or the feared effect that people
would.
That's
exactly right.
Okay. Well, let's go to our listeners.
It's really kind of a way to think of it is that we don't want people to speed on the highway, but if they are going to speed on the highway, I'm glad they wear their seatbelt.
The exchange number for you to join us with your questions or comments about what HIV/AIDS looks like in New Hampshire today, almost 30 years after World AIDS Day was established, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Dr. Leahy, Laura Byrne, let's go to our listeners. Chris joins us from Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
So my impression, you asked about the impression, or what does the average person think?
Right.
I don't think I'm necessarily average, but my impression of what they think is that, this is still kind of predominantly a gay disease, or that this is, something that happens with drug addicts and people who are overly promiscuous, but, it doesn't happen to ordinary, decent people. That's my general impression. The other thing, if I can just follow up with a question, is that I'm very concerned about the heroin epidemic and how that might be contributing as a accelerator of it.
Chris, that is a great question, and one I did want to ask both of you. So Laura Byrne, to you first. Many listeners might be familiar with the story of that small rural county in Indiana. I think it was Scott County, where all of a sudden HIV spiked due to IV drug use, due to the drug epidemic. So, Chris, your question is relevant. Laura, can you fill us in, please?
Yes, that's a really great example of what could happen, because Austin in Indiana is a semi-rural area and only has about 4,200 people. And within a six-month period, there were almost, I think the final number was 190 new HIV infections. Just a few people were infected originally, and then because of sharing injection drug equipment, more people became infected, and it spread to 190 people. And unfortunately, during the time, the governor Mike Pence did not open syringe exchange in a timely fashion. If he had authorized the opening of syringe exchanges in Indiana, it might have curtailed the epidemic sooner. But it took almost a year to get 6 months to get everything in place to open syringe exchange. And then they did a program, a targeted HIV testing program called social networks testing. So they, based on the premise that people in the same social networks have similar risk behaviors, it's an incentivized program, so they encouraged injection drug users to come in, sign up for health insurance, get gift cards, and they asked them who their injection partners were, and then they tracked those people, and ultimately they were able to curtail that. But and that's a similar kind of thing that could happen in any state without syringe exchange, such as New Hampshire. New Hampshire still does not have syringe exchange, while Vermont does. And actually, I think Vermont, the number of people who contract HIV from injection drug use is less than in New Hampshire.
Well, and Laura, you mentioned Vice President-elect Pence's reluctance to put a needle exchange program in place. This is a touchy subject for people.
Yeah.
Here in New Hampshire, you know, we don't have a needle exchange program either, although it's come up in the legislature. So it's tricky for folks, Laura, who don't want to be seen to be encouraging drug use by handing out clean needles. So how do you work through that?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence. And in fact, I think the New York Department of Health in its entirety went to Indiana to speak with Governor Pence at the time about the evidence that indicates that in areas where there are syringe exchange programs, there are a greater number of people actually getting into and being retained in drug treatment programs. There are fewer needles that are found on the street. There are more needles being returned to the exchange. Syringe exchange programs generally also offer free HIV and hepatitis testing, hepatitis C testing. Hepatitis C is also a big problem for injection drug users. And so it doesn't, my opinion and the opinion of many health professionals is that syringe exchange does not promote drug use. It actually ultimately helps curtail it.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for the question. Dr. Leahy, to you too, how has New Hampshire's opioid addiction crisis affected the work that you're doing with AIDS patients?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I want to thank Chris first for calling our attention to the fact that, you know, all of us live at risk of HIV, and we don't want to think of it as something that's confined only to a certain population. And at the same time, we want to make sure we support people who are at risk. The injection drug users are historically about a quarter of the U.S. HIV epidemic, about a quarter of our clinic. And so they need special attention. And this is, you know, no more important than right now. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed us within the last couple of years that the number of opioid overdoses in New Hampshire rose by 73.5%.
Wow.
So we are in the middle of just a raging fire of heroin and other opiate abuse. And so far, our HIV cases have not seen an uptick, but our expectation is that it's basically a matter of time that we have something like Indiana happen, because we know that, you know, you can imagine if you have a group of injection drug users who are sharing needles, if none of them currently has HIV, then HIV won't spread. If one person shows up in that population with HIV, which wouldn't be a shocker, then that infection, which is incurable and lethal, will spread rapidly through the population. And the last thing any of us want is for that to happen.
Wow, Dr. Leahy, a pretty sobering prediction there. We will talk more in a moment. Chris, thank you so much for the call. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at HIV and AIDS in the Granite State. almost 30 years out from the establishment of World AIDS Day, which is December 1st. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. How do you think people view HIV and AIDS today? What questions do you have about treatment and possible cure for this disease? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Dr. Leahy, Laura Byrne, right back to our listeners. Ruth joins us from Wilton. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I was interested, or I guess a little annoyed, by the argument that apparently people are making about preventative medication for people with to prevent HIV and AIDS. And the reason is that I think that argument makes about as much sense as it makes to withhold birth control products from young people who we'd prefer not to have babies.
So, Ruth, you're not buying that argument at all, and it doesn't concern you.
I'm sorry?
You're not buying the argument that having preventative drugs encourages risky behavior.
No, yeah. I don't think that providing birth control to, you know, people we prefer not to have babies, you know, very young people, teenagers, I think we found I understand that keeping those products away from young people isn't a very effective way to prevent pregnancies and premarital sex. And I think the argument about HIV and AIDS is pretty much the same. I don't think that withholding the preventative products is probably likely to have very much of an effect on people's behavior.
Well, Ruth, thank you so much for calling. And, you know, Dr. Leahy, one more question about these products that we didn't get to before. How expensive are they, and does insurance typically cover them?
Yeah, so this is a really important point that this is not a question about morals. This is a question about science, and the science is clear. Preventive measures like safe needle exchanges and PrEP do not increase the risk of risk behaviors. Needle exchanges are cheap, and so I think it's nuts not to use them. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, is expensive, and so it's really important to use it wisely for people at the highest risk. The financial models are being debated by a bunch of countries all around the world, but estimates are that it can save lives and save money from care, but it only is true if it's given to the people at highest risk. So how much it costs per life saved kind of depends on, you know, how high risk the people are that you give it to. But people think that it's in the order of $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year saved.
Does insurance typically cover this drug, drugs like Truvada, Dr. Leahy?
Yeah. Good insurance companies like Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and other sort of main ones do typically cover it. I think they and many health officials in different countries that are facing the expenditures related to this are swallowing hard at the likely cost of it. But the most enlightened ones are taking the long picture, where they know that $1 invested today can save $2 invested tomorrow. So it'd be nice not to spend that dollar today, but it's the wise thing to do.
Well, Dr. Leahy, Laura Byrne, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Wendy LeBlanc is with us, Vice President of the Southern New Hampshire AIDS Task Force. And Wendy LeBlanc, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've been looking at how the whole conversation and treatment and approach towards HIV/AIDS has changed over the last almost 30 years. Years, really. I just wonder what you've noticed in your corner of the state.
Yeah, sure. I've been listening, and certainly everything that Laura and Tim have shared is absolutely what I would share as well. But we do have a great resource to share with your listeners. The New Hampshire HIV Planning Group has put together a website and has done a lot of work putting together a section about PrEP. And so anyone that's interested and doesn't know how to get it or where to get it, all the information is on that website, and it's simply nhhiv.org, and then follow the tab to All About PrEP, and it tells you where to get it, how to pay for it, all of that sort of stuff. So I want to make sure people are aware of that.
And when were you first able, Wendy, to start talking to people about this AIDS prevention. I mean, just from a scientific point of view, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, it's been several years that PrEP has been available, but it's really become more widely talked about in the last year or two. And it's been during that time that we realized that, as Laura said earlier, a lot of general practitioners are not prescribing. But there are, for example, any Planned Parenthood location in the state has a PrEP clinic. And again, these resources are listed on that webpage that I mentioned. So there's lots of availability now, but it's still not really commonly well-known, except for in the HIV community.
And who's coming to you these days, Wendy, for help at Southern New Hampshire AIDS Task Force?
You know, it's really not that different. As Laura said, the state of New Hampshire only, fortunately, about 40 new infections each year. The folks that we're getting sometimes are these new infections, but more often than not are people who are moving back to New Hampshire or moving to New Hampshire for the first time and already know that they're living with HIV, but they need assistance in paying for the medication. And the more heartbreaking situations are the people who had been working, who had private insurance, who were paying for their medications independently, didn't need services from an agency like ours, and now all of a sudden they've lost their job, they've lost their insurance, and they have no way to pay for these services. And that's what we help folks with.
Well, and Wendy, we talked earlier with Dr. Leahy and Laura Byrne about the idea that, you know, the perception that this is a disease of the 80s and 90s, and now it's mostly an African problem, and it doesn't really concern us. And I wonder if you bump up against that impression as well.
Oh, absolutely. But I think sometimes I live in a little bit of a bubble because I work in this community and live in this community. So I'm always aware of what's happening. But sure, when I meet people who aren't particularly well-informed about HIV, it is pretty amazing that people just aren't thinking about it anymore, thinking that it's a concern.
You know, Laura, I want to ask you about this too. I was looking again yesterday and today. In Britain, there's an ad campaign, you know, put forward for World AIDS Day. People dressed in 1980s and early 90s clothes. There's one funny guy holding a very large cell phone. And the slogan in this is AIDS stigma. It's not just retro, it's wrong. I was kind of struck by that, Laura. Do you think some people see AIDS as kind of a retro 80s, 90s thing?
I think that some young people think of AIDS as an 80s, 90s thing, and that they, for some reason, they're not aware that HIV is still in our communities. I would say that it's more of, I think the thing that's impeding people from actually addressing HIV, aside from the complacency that we talked about earlier, is stigma. And I think that there's a testing stigma, and people don't think that they should get tested because it won't happen to them. But that's not the case. It's entirely dependent on behavior, and if you've come across HIV, and the only way to know if you have HIV is to get tested. So we're promoting testing, sort of testing for everybody, as a way to reduce the stigma around HIV and around HIV testing, and then have everybody know their status.
What's the stigma about, Laura?
There are some people that still think that HIV is a gay disease, that or it's a disease that drug users have. And indeed, it's true that men who have sex with men make up over 50% of people living with HIV in both New Hampshire and Vermont. But heterosexual contact is responsible for about 19 or 20% of people living with HIV, and I think that we have to broaden our perspective. HIV is an equal opportunity virus, and anybody can get HIV, and I'm not sure that people always realize that.
So about 20%, that might come as a surprise to some people, Dr. Leahy. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true, and you know, I think any conversation about retro thinking about HIV and stigma also asks, what is the modern point of view on HIV? How should we be thinking about it? And I think there the answer is very clear, that, you know, we are a community, we are neighbors, we are brothers and sisters, and we don't want to give our concern and our love only to people who look and act exactly like us. That I just want my neighbors and my brothers and sisters to be healthy And if they need HIV testing, if they need HIV therapy, I really don't care how they are at risk for getting it. I want to make sure they have that. And I think most good people understand that that's true. What's sad is that sometimes our political conversation can devolve into finger pointing and scapegoating, and men who have sex with men or injection drug users can be depicted in those public conversations as bad people. And in fact, they're not. They're ordinary people just like everybody. And I think we should just, you know, move beyond that kind of stigma and think about how we as a society want to take care of people who deserve help.
The exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're getting a look at HIV and AIDS in New Hampshire, given that World AIDS Day is this week on Thursday, and given the shifting perceptions around the disease and also new types of treatment and even preventative medicines. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And joining us from Concord is John. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead, John.
So I'm living with HIV, and I use Truvada combined with a couple other medications, and I take them on a daily basis. Right now, my insurance covers 70% of the medications, and I end up paying for 30, although I'm on a program that pays for that for me. But my medications cost upwards of $6,000 for the three of them. So if I were not on the program that pays for it, the copay, then I would be paying near $2,000 a month.
Wow, John, it's a lot of money.
That is. There are other medications I could switch to, but it's risky to switch because others may not work as well. That would be cheaper, but they're still near $2,700, and I'd be paying around $900 a month. And it's all dependent on my income. If I make more than a certain amount of money, then I lose the program that helps me pay the copay.
So if you start making more money, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's anything being done about reducing the cost of the medication.
Well, definitely want to ask our guests about that, John, but if I could ask you a quick question, is that all right?
Sure.
How do you feel on a day-to-day basis, taking these drugs? I have read that, sometimes you feel pretty crappy.
The ones I'm on don't really have any effect. Truvada is a great drug. The other two, Norvir and Prazista, don't really have any effect on me. I was on a medication previously that made you feel a little high, and I switched because of that to these three drugs that I'm on now. And on a daily basis, I feel like a normal person. I forget that I have it, except for when I have to take my pill every day.
Wow. So you're able to work and do what you need to do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, John, good luck to you. And I'm really glad that you called in. And maybe I'll turn to you first, Wendy LeBlanc, on that. He's wondering about the prospects of lowering the cost of some of these drugs that are allowing him to be a, functioning member of society.
Yeah, sure. I mean, unfortunately, it's not really my area of expertise of how the drug companies set their prices. Of course, we all know that once the patent runs out, then they can become generic. But most of the medications that our clients are taking these days are a combination pill that has 2 to 3 medicines in each pill, and I don't see any generics coming anywhere down the line for those. But as John mentioned, there is an assistance program through the state of New Hampshire that's federally funded that goes to every state in the country, and as long as a person is at or below 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $47,000 for a single person, they can get assistance in paying their copays or even paying the full cost of their meds if they don't have any insurance.
You know, Dr. Leahy, I think Wendy just mentioned that a lot of these, I don't want to call them cures, treatments that help people manage as well as our caller does, are a combination of drugs, as Wendy said. And I read about a lawsuit, Dr. Leahy, that, there's some concern that the drug companies are keeping these treatments as a combination of pills instead of one single easy pill, because it slows down the movement of generics to market. I wonder what you know about that.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to really underline and bold is that John is a living example of the success story of HIV. We've gone from HIV being a uniformly lethal disease that would take young people in the prime of their life down in several years to being something where people on the great kinds of medicines like John mentioned can who can access that and take it regularly can live as long as if they did not have HIV at all. And as he said, most of them can live quite comfortably in relationships and jobs and living the kinds of lives we all want.
That is a big change, Dr. Leahy, because again, earlier it was, you know, some people said the drugs were as bad as a disease. You just felt so terrible on them.
That is right. And that's why it's so important for testing to happen so that people who need it can access those services. It turns out that a minority of people with HIV access those services because either they don't know that they have HIV or they don't have they can't access care for one reason or another. But that great care does come at a cost, and that's partly why some people don't get on treatment is because of insurance issues. And, you know, there are different sides to this that we balance. The drug companies have done a great job innovating so that they've got drugs that patients can take safely and comfortably, and I think they should be rewarded for that. But we want to make sure that the rewards that they're getting are not excessive, that they're not, charging more than they should. Nowadays, most of my patients are on one pill once a day, and it's working. But as Wendy said, those medicines are not going to go off patent for another decade.
So it's it's no longer this sort of complicated cocktail that people have to take. It can be one pill once a day.
That's right. I'd say most patients have that's their experience.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call, John. And let's go to Laconia, where Trevor is on the air. Hi, Trevor. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that I take Truvada PrEP for HIV prevention, and my insurance didn't cover it all. But the company that makes it, Gilead, did have a prescription coupon that covered the entire rest of the cost. And so even though my insurance hasn't been able to cover it all, the company that makes it did have a program that allowed me to take it free of charge. So I just wanted to share that as for those that are thinking of going on it but may not want to or intimidated by the cost.
Wow. And Trevor, same question. So how are you feeling?
Oh, I feel fine. There's absolutely no side effects. It's purely for HIV prevention. Both me and many of my friends take it. And I've never heard of anyone having any side effects from it.
Okay. Trevor, thank you so much for the call. Laura Byrne, you want to jump in real quickly? Coupons to help people pay for it when insurance coverage is a problem.
Yes, there are. And if you can, I think if you go to the Gilead website, you can find them at their Truvada Assistance Program. And I know we have clients that use Truvada for prevention, and they're able to pay for it because of that.
Well, Trevor, thank you for calling in, and we'll take a lot more of your calls in just a moment. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you like, NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at HIV and AIDS in New Hampshire. World AIDS Day is this week, and it has been a long time since the world has been focused on fighting this disease. Now we're looking at some of the myths and misconceptions about it, given the prevalence of new drugs for prevention and treatment. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Here's an email from Joe in Newmarket who says, I'm in a mixed status relationship, partner positive, and I'm negative. Joe says he's a long-term survivor and was diagnosed in 1986. Wow. His disease is well managed, and I often forget he's positive. Joe says, I've experienced stigma indirectly throughout our time together. People ask if I'm terrified of contracting the disease. I'm not. His virus is undetectable, and we are careful. We know the science of transmission for couples in our situation. Joe says a huge cause of stigma is lack of understanding, especially among younger members of the gay community, of which I'm one, who weren't exposed to the epidemic in the early years. And Wendy, can you pick up on that last sentence? Joe, thank you for the email. Lack of understanding, especially among younger members of the gay community, to quote Joe. I wonder what you think, Wendy.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see that simply because the younger guys weren't alive in the 80s and early 90s when when folks were dying. And those of us who are a bit older and have been around through that and lost friends and loved ones during that time do remember that, and we do know what happens when these medications aren't available or when these medications aren't taken. But again, young guys weren't even alive when this was happening, so the risk doesn't seem as real to them.
So how do you get around that, Wendy?
I think just continuing the education that Dr. Tim and Laura talked about, and your programs like yours, letting people know that this is still a communicable public health issue and we need to be aware of it. One of the things that you hadn't had a chance to mention yet that I think is real important for folks to know when we're talking about prevention, Joe mentioned that his partner's virus is undetectable. That's a huge step in prevention for HIV. What that means is when a person is taking medication and they're taking it every day the way that they're supposed to, and the virus is suppressed to a point where it's no longer damaging their immune system, it also makes them virtually, like 99%, Dr. Leahy can give the exact percentage, makes them unable to transmit the virus to their partner, even if they weren't using protection. So we now know that treatment of HIV is prevention. And in New Hampshire, we have very good statistics regarding this.
So, Dr. Leahy, is that a cure then?
It's not a cure, but it's a darn effective treatment. Wendy's exactly right that big studies came out in fall of 2016 showing that in hundreds of couples, just like Joe's, where one member was HIV positive and the other one was not, that effective therapy was associated with absolutely zero cases of HIV transmission. We think it's still possible, as Wendy alluded to, that some people in rare cases can get infected if their partner is on therapy and they don't use condoms, but it's becoming extremely rare because the therapy is so powerful. You still have to take the therapy lifelong. It doesn't cure the disease, but man, it's good medicine if you have to take it.
Let's take another call. Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. A couple of observations. First of all, I teach at a college setting, and I echo the sentiment that in that population it's passe about HIV, and it's not of their concern at all. Number two, there were studies out of Africa about the role of circumcision in prevention of AIDS. And I think that should be commented upon.
So not a concern at all of you. Oh, go ahead, Steve. Okay, I think we lost Steve there. But two comments that he raises that we should talk about. And Laura Byrne, to his first point, he teaches at a college. Not a concern at all. What do you think?
Well, I think that it depends on the college. Some colleges are making an effort to raise awareness about HIV. I know that we live right next to Dartmouth College in Hanover, and they have a sex fest where they talk about HIV, they talk about safe sex, they talk about STDs. But I think that in general, college students are more concerned with pregnancy than they are HIV. And so sometimes I go give talks at college. I think we just have to keep getting the word out. I've been doing a lot of evening testing for people to try to raise awareness about testing, because really the only way that we'll find the people with the new infections is for them to get tested, because you can have HIV for a good 8 to 10 years without having any symptoms.
Wow. Laura, is testing done in the home these days as well, or do you still have to go into a clinic or a doctor's office?
Well, it is. You can buy a test at CVS and do it yourself in your home.
Really?
And yes. And it's pretty much the same test that we're using now, or you can come to an agency such as ours and have a free test, which many people do. But it's very easy to access tests now. It's just a question of taking the time and making the effort to do it. And I think that's where stigma comes in. Sometimes people don't realize that they might have been, they might have contracted HIV. They're just not thinking, oh, it could happen to me. And so that's why I'm a big promoter of getting everybody tested.
Well, and Wendy, when someone does testing at home, is there a concern there that, you know, they get a bad result and they're all by themselves and...
Well,
you know,
I think the school of thought has evolved over the years. I mean, back in the day, it was very we felt it was very important to somebody have pre-test counseling and post-test counseling, and that you'd be prepared for your test result. And not that that's a bad thing, but it's just in our modern society, people want quick answers. People still want a private answer because of the stigma, again. And again, because we know this is not a fatal disease anymore, and we hope that somebody, if they do get a positive result, is going to seek care and seek treatment, then as soon as they do that, if they do have questions, those will be answered. So, frankly, I'd rather have somebody test at home than not test at all.
Yeah, well, not fatal maybe, but still pretty scary, Wendy.
Absolutely, and I don't mean to minimize that in any way. But again, like Laura said, the more people that know their status, and like Dr. Leahy said, they can get on these medications and they're effective, and they the sooner they know, the sooner they get on the medications, the less chance the virus has done to damage their immune system. So the sooner people know, the better, and I think in any way that can happen, we need to be responsive to that.
Dr. Leahy, to Steve's question also about sub-Saharan Africa, do higher rates of circumcision among males lower the rate of transmission of AIDS?
Yes. Actually, now we have both epidemiological studies and randomized clinical trials showing that men who are circumcised as adults have a 60% lower likelihood of contracting HIV infection. So this is a relatively new member of our HIV prevention toolkit. It is a method of HIV prevention that's only being used in areas where the epidemic is really raging and where the prevalence of HIV is quite high, like sub-Saharan African countries, so that it's the, you know, the risks of the surgical procedure, the discomfort, the cost, et cetera, are warranted.
Well, you said circumcised as adults, so it doesn't apply to those who were circumcised as children, or...?
Epidemiological studies do suggest that in countries where circumcision is common at birth, that HIV is less common. As you can imagine, that's a much harder clinical trial to do because you have to wait until adulthood to see if the person actually ends up contracting HIV. But the presumption is it works just as well that way, too.
Well, and while we're talking about Africa, I just read this morning, Dr. Leahy, that there's a vaccine that I think they're going to roll out in South Africa tomorrow as we approach World AIDS Day. Why isn't there a vaccine yet? And what are some of the hopes around this possible new vaccine?
Yeah, wouldn't it be great to move beyond the great therapies that we have today and some of the, you know, political conversations we have to just a stone-cold cure that could save the world from the HIV epidemic? And fortunately, I don't think we're too far away. So about 5 years ago, the first HIV vaccine to show some effect in clinical trials was revealed. There was a huge study of thousands of people in Thailand who got a vaccine called RV144 that about 30% of the time lowered the likelihood of HIV transmission. So it wasn't a spectacular vaccine, but it seemed to work. So this new study, which just started in South Africa, looks at a modified version of that vaccine that researchers hope is going to be more effective.
Yeah, 35%
that works,
isn't
that could
great.
Be a game changer.
Yeah, 30% is not wonderful.
Yeah, you know, you can imagine that if, you know, nowadays about 2 million people are newly infected with HIV worldwide every year. And so if a 30% effective vaccine was given to each of those at-risk people, that might save something like 600,000 people every year from getting HIV. So that's not small potatoes, But boy, it would be awesome if it was as good as other vaccines and maybe three quarters of them could be protected.
You know, Dr. Leahy, following up on something you just said, you said, wouldn't it be nice to move away from political conversations about AIDS and, you know, have a vaccine that cures this for once and for all? What are the political conversations about AIDS as you hear them?
You know, I think we've, in our society, we've gotten into sort of an unhealthy rut where we pit morality against science. And so we say, well, I'm concerned about sexual behavior that doesn't fit with, you know, my personal set of morals, and therefore I might oppose, you know, giving PrEP or using condoms, or I might not want people to use drugs, and so I'll oppose needle exchanges. I think it's time for us to mature beyond that and say that across all religious persuasions, across all political stripes, all of us have strong morals. And bedrock to those morals is that we care about each other and that we want to give treatment to people who need it and prevention to people who need it, and the rest is just noise. And I think if we can come together as communities around that idea of respect and concern for our neighbors, we'll go a lot farther, and then we'll just provide the condoms where they're needed, we'll provide the PrEP, the testing where it's needed, the needle exchanges where they're needed, and we'll save lives.
Wendy LeBlanc, what do you bump up against, again, at the Southern New Hampshire AIDS Task Force? You know, concerns about politics, concerns about should we be helping, who we should be helping, who deserves help, who doesn't. I wonder what you think about what Dr. Leahy says.
Well, I completely agree with him, and I think we should vote for Dr. Leahy.
I think he's busy, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. You know, I don't really know how to say anything more eloquent than he said. Again, because I work in this field, I don't hear a lot of that in my day-to-day basis. And my agency is part of a larger partnership of nonprofit agencies that help a whole myriad of vulnerable populations, including folks with substance use disorder and mental illness and homelessness. So we have a very large helping community here in Nashua and in other parts of the state that I don't run into that too much in my professional life. My personal life, certainly I bump into folks that may have a different view on things, and I just do my best to kindly educate them and make them understand some of those ideas that Dr. Leahy just shared.
Laura Byrne, what's going to make your job easier if you could just wave your magic wand and, you know, fix this thing? What would make your job at the HIV-HCV Resource Center in Lebanon just perfect?
Well, I really like my job, actually. But I think that if everybody got tested and we found out, and people who are living with, the one out of six people who do not know their status that they're living with HIV, found out that they were living with HIV and could get on treatment faster, that would be great. I also run our needle exchange program, which is in Vermont, and I think having access to substance misuse treatment for all of my clients and having it all paid for, that would also be great because they really struggle.
Are you going to be working in the coming legislative year for a needle exchange program again? This came up in the legislature.
Yes.
The House passed some form of a bill. The Senate said, let's study it for a while. Go ahead.
Right. I think they felt that the bill was too it was Joe Hannon who put forth that bill, and I think that they felt like it was too broad, and so it's back to the drawing board. But I think this is the year that a bill decriminalizing drug residue on needles or something like it can pass to pave the way for syringe exchange in New Hampshire, because I think New Hampshire really needs syringe exchange.
So a wish for needle exchanges. Laura, you also have said several times this morning that you'd love for everybody to get tested. How do you even go about that? I mean, in what sort of venue would that take place?
Well, I do sort of pop-up testing in various communities. I'm part of an intentional LGBT community where I offer testing from a camping tent in the summers, and I do testing at our syringe exchange. The testing that I'm offering often targets high-risk people, but I also feel like it's really important for everybody to have a test at least once, because there might be people that aren't necessarily high risk that are acquiring HIV. I'm sure there are, and for them to get tested and find out their status would be great.
How would you accomplish that, Wendy LeBlanc? Get everybody tested?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we are relying on the medical community and our primary care providers to acknowledge and recognize that this is a human virus. It's not based on who you are or what you are or what you do necessarily, and that everybody should be tested, and it should be just part of your regular annual cholesterol check and blood counts and all of that sort of thing, so that everybody's getting tested.
And
in New Hampshire, too, it's important to know that we have a very high, what they call a concurrent diagnosis rate, which means people are finding out that they have HIV and within less than a year also have an AIDS diagnosis, which means that they didn't get tested early on and they're already very ill before they even know it. And then it's much more difficult to treat, much more expensive to treat, and that's why when people still die. And we have folks like that coming in all the time. I just found out, and yet they're very immunocompromised.
You know, I have to ask you this, Wendy, and I apologize because we're running out of time, but that image of, you know, regular checkup and, you know, checking with your doctor and how you doing and cholesterol levels. I mean, that's kind of a cozy image. I wonder how many people at risk of contracting HIV or AIDS have that kind of medical care.
Right, which is why we have a health care for the homeless clinic here in Nashua to help folks that wouldn't be accessing regular primary care and other new innovative ways like this.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you so much. Real interesting stuff. Wendy LeBlanc, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
That's Wendy LeBlanc, Vice President of the Southern New Hampshire AIDS Task Force. Laura Byrne, thank you also for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Laura Byrne, Executive Director of the HIV-HCV Resource Center in Lebanon, which, by the way, serves both New Hampshire and Vermont. And Dr. Leahy, thank you also. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Dr. Tim Leahy, Associate Professor of Medicine at Dartmouth and a clinical immunologist with a focus on HIV and tuberculosis. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.